Hello and welcome to Symphonies and Snacks, a podcast where we discuss contemporary classical music and food. That was part of Glass's Hero Symphony, Symphony No. 4, based on the Heroes album by David Bowie. I didn't introduce us. I'm Lucy.
And I'm Jono.
And we're going to talk all things Bowie and Glass today. Yay! We're trying to something a little bit different with the sound this week. We had some problems with sound last week, more than 2 weeks ago. And apologies for that. We're trying to sort it. We want to produce the best possible quality podcast we can. Because, you know, we're raking in the big bucks for it. So all of that money, we need to put it to some use. Also apologies for the break. We had a busy couple of weeks and then I got ill and had no voice. And you can't do an audio podcast with no voice.
Yeah, and then we had to try and line up times you weren't ill with times that we could both sit down and record a podcast. So
I've had a very busy few weeks. I got old.
That was enjoyable and less enjoyable for me.
I had a gathering around at my house. I had some friends around, including Johnny. We do hang out. I thought it was going to be a nice twee afternoon. Because we were doing Roald Dahl food.
Which was very tasty.
But the George's Marvelous Medicine cocktail making, you fell foul of that, would you say?
No, I had some rum, but that was mainly because at the same time as your gathering, I was also watching the rugby and it wasn't going well for me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I made you watch it with people who weren't Australia supporters. Yeah. I'm sorry.
And I had to traipse across the whole of London wearing my Australia shirt, so after we'd lost. So that was fun.
Well, as someone who is half Scottish, I feel no sympathy for you.
Fair enough. I don't think many people in this country do.
Nope. Should we talk about Bowie? Should we carry on talking about the exciting things we've done the past 2 weeks?
Let's talk about Bowie. That's why we're here. That's why they are paying us those big bucks you mentioned.
Mm. Yeah, they're not paying us to talk about my birthday and getting old. Old. Yeah. I'm no longer in the youth section of Girl Guiding anymore.
Oh, no.
I know. So old. The Hero Symphony. So this is the second of Glass's symphonies based on the work of David Bowie. And it's based on part of the Berlin trilogy, which is made up, which is three of Bowie's albums that he made with Brian Eno.
Yep.
So the other two are Low and Lodger. And it was, I've run out of information, I'm very sorry.
Well, it was all made in the late 70s, all three of them.
77?
Heroes was 77, and I think the other two were 76 and 79 off the top of my head.
They were created with Brian Eno, and Bowie, I believe Bowie met Brian Eno at a Philip Glass concert in 1971. When he performed in London, Eno and Bowie were both there and stood next to each other. So, those three albums are influenced by Glass, written by Eno and Bowie, who were then the albums were taken up by Glass and rewritten into the symphonies as a tribute back to them. Does that make sense?
Sort of.
Basically, it's a big old lovin'.
Yeah. All three of them influencing each other and copying each other's work. Well, not copying, but creating work based on the work that's already been created based on their own work. But I'm getting to tie myself up in a knot if I continue this.
It's like Inception, but symphonies. Yeah.
Except I found Inception straightforward, whereas this is quite complex.
Yes. And all a little bit lovey.
Yeah.
So, should we listen to part of the symphony?
Let's go for that, yeah.
Should we go first movement?
I think that's the best place to start. Thank you.
So, I recently talked about this work with a student who was 19 or 20. I think he was a first year student. No, second year. Composition student at university. And I started explaining because he was asking about the ethics of musical quoting. So that's the same as quoting in any language where you just, you know, literally take part of somebody's music and put it into your work. And I started to explain the Hero Symphony to him, started playing it to him, and then realised he had no idea what Heroes was.
So he didn't have the context of the original quote?
He didn't know any Bowie at all.
And he's a music student?
He's a music student. He got to 19 and never listened to any Bowie.
Okay. Did you put him right on that?
I did. But he was just a bit, I think I was a bit intense because I was just like, how, you've missed it out. Why are you studying music if you don't care enough to listen to Bowie? And yeah. No, I didn't say care enough. That would have been really cruel.
Yeah, I mean.
Do you hate music? Do you only listen to Bach? What are you doing here? Who are you? How?
I feel like we should not tear this guy down completely. Everyone has their blind spots.
Yeah. Bowie is not one of mine. I love Bowie.
Yeah, I love Bowie.
Do you know what I really love that he does? Is he just drops albums. Like, before it was cool, before Beyonce was doing it, he was just, like, on his birthday one year, he just released an album.
Yeah.
He just kind of went, there you go.
His most recent one, not the one that he's now trailing will be coming out late next year, but the one that came out last year. And everyone was like, hey, Bowie's made a new album. No one knew that was happening.
So much cooler than, like, Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
Like, Paul McCartney tried to do that, but everyone knew it was coming, and he promoted it. And it's like, if you're going to just drop an album, you can't promote it. You have to just be like, there it is. That's yours.
Yeah.
So cool. You know, for it. He survived a lot.
Well, musically he survived, I think, by being very adaptable to whatever's going on at the time.
Mm.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah, he's not exactly adapted, he's kind of evolved.
He always sort of has a feel for where the zeitgeist is and does something that works with it.
But not, so most recently, Sue, have you heard Sue?
Yeah.
It's, yeah. Got this real kind of experimental jazz feel.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really suit what's in the charts or what's going on elsewhere, but it works.
Yeah.
So,
he's been able to evolve his musical style to keep it fresh and interesting.
Should we listen to a bit of Heroes?
Yeah, we're talking the Bowie album now. Yes, let's listen to that.
Yeah, let's listen to the piece that the symphony is based on. So I think the interesting things to kind of point out is, so that was influenced by Philip Glass, as I said. Philip Glass is an American composer. Mm-hmm. I found out recently he's Ira Glass's cousin. So Ira Glass, who does This American Life on NPR. Is that an NPR one?
Maybe, I don't know.
So he's quite big in the States. And I was listening to an interview with him on an Alec Baldwin podcast called Here's the Thing. This is all very podcast heavy. Have you ever heard the Alec Baldwin?
Yeah. I don't know that podcast, no.
So basically, it's Alec Baldwin interrupting people with a better anecdote. So okay. He gets his mates on and then he goes, oh, yeah, but when I met that person, this happened. And it's all a lot of one-upping. But he was talking to Ira Glass. He was like, oh, yeah, we decided we wanted to write a piece about this thing. So I asked my cousin, Philip Glass. I was like, oh, I hadn't put two and two together. Anyway, what Glass does really well is minimalism. So for people who haven't come across minimalism, it's repeated patterns. So it's repeating and repeating and repeating, and it'll change gradually. So you might just change one note, or you might just change a little bit of the rhythm and just keep repeating, keep repeating, keep repeating. And it's quite hypnotic. Do you have anything to add to that?
I'd say that's a very good description of minimalism. It's maybe...
I mean,
fair to say that's where Glass started out, but that's probably not where he is these days.
So, I suppose the point in relation to Bowie's heroes is that he uses the repeated patterns in it, but he also used the minimalism to move away from a verse chorus structure.
Yeah.
So it's not strophic.
Yes, all of the three Berlin albums have a slightly experimental edge to them. The songs don't fit standard song form, although, you know, Bowie had been doing that since the 60s. There's more instrumentals on them than you'd normally expect to find on a pop album as well.
But Heroes as a song has no chorus. I mean, you have the We Can Be Heroes bit, but that's not... That's a refrain, it's not a chorus.
It's just one line that comes back from time to time.
Yeah. So that's how that song was influenced by the Glass. Mm-hmm. And the other interesting thing is bringing in Brian Eno and his ways of working into it. So that's quite in the effects used and the production and all that. You can really hear Eno's influence. I have problems with Eno. I disagree with some of his more recent work. I'm getting very tangential today.
You're qualified to speak on him, given that in some ways is an overlap between what you do and what he does.
So I do electronic sound installations, and I take sound and I put it in public places, and I put it in public places to kind of make people stop what they're doing and listen. So kind of do something fun, stop and take some time out and really listen to what's going on. But Eno's whole thing is he's done a lot of sound installations that are music for airports and music for hospitals and things like that. And his whole thing is the music exists fully when you're not listening to it. So as soon as you listen to the sound, it loses its meaning. In his more recent work.
He's quite committed to his theories, I think.
Disagree with that.
Yeah.
If something's good, listen.
He wants his music to be ambient, as in not something you're consciously engaging with, something that's just there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an interesting contrast to Bowie, because I think Bowie, you really do stop and listen.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Bowie demands your attention.
Mm. So let's go back to the Glass Hero Symphony.
Yeah.
So the elements that Glass has taken from the Bowie, there's some really kind of interesting things to do with, you know, he's weaved the melody in and stuff like that. But, you know, there's big differences in orchestration and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I want to come on to the orchestration later because I just have questions about the orchestration. But in terms of weaving those musical quotes in, and to bring it back to this student that I'd had that really big, in-depth conversation about musical quoting with,
mm-hmm.
How much is this Glass's work, do you think?
I think that... Well, I think that's it is Glass's work. I think there's no question that he is the author of this. Mm. The reason I say that is, although, yeah, he is quoting a piece of work by Bowie and Eno, I mean, you have to listen quite hard to spot the quotes sometimes. And he has definitely put his own stamp on it. It's more than just an arrangement of the album Heroes for Orchestra. There's very glassy stuff going on in the string accompaniment, for example, on most of the movements is, you know, very much a glass repetitive thing. And so from my point of view, I think quoting is fine. You know, he's not making a secret of where he's got this from. It's not like he's trying to steal Bowie's work. He's saying, look, here is a symphony. I've written it based on this work by David Bowie.
But I mean, there is kind of an ethical... I consider this to be fully Glass's work. I would say it's more used the Bowie as a starting point.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say.
Yeah. But it's a really hard sell to students, that idea of musical quoting and it still being your work. I suppose it's because they're still learning at the same time how to orchestrate.
Yeah.
So there's two schools of orchestration. So that's when you move something into, you know, being for an orchestra, being for different instruments. You take the harmonies and the melodies, you split them up, you work through. And there's two ways that you can do it. You can be very literal and just kind of do a by numbers orchestration that's quite functional. Or you can take a composer, arranger role and split things up a bit more creatively, build different lines, pull different things out. It's kind of hard to explain in an abstract way.
At that point, as the arranger, the orchestrator, you're actually making artistic decisions without any direct input from the original composer. If you're deciding where to put this melody, where to double it, things like that, that's an artistic decision that you're taking autonomously.
Yeah. But I would say this goes further than that. I would really just say it's a launch pad. It's a vibe. So you listen to it and you get this, it's almost like a memory of the Bowie.
Yeah.
I think that's the best way to put it is. Do you know that Dirty Projectors album?
You know what? That was just coming into my head as well. Is it Black Flag, isn't it?
Do you know, I don't know the name of it off the top of my head.
I think it is Black Flag. Or Black Flag might be the original band.
So Dirty Projectors are a band from the... Are they from the States?
Yeah, I think they're from New York.
New York. And they wrote an album which was the memory of an album that they'd listened to years and years before. And they couldn't remember fully, and they decided to recreate it, but without re-listening to it.
Yeah, the band that the original album for was Black Flag, and their album was Rise Above, which was based on the Black Flag album Damaged.
Yeah,
having quickly found all that. Yeah, they hadn't heard it for 15 years, and from memory they tried to recreate it in their own way.
Well, I kind of feel this is what the Glass is.
Yeah.
But could you get the kind of floating da 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 melody coming in and out?
It's in there, but it's not the whole of the thing.
Mm. Yeah. And I think it's... here's a question. If you were going to do a tribute, you know, get into a symbiotic kind of tribute relationship like Bowie and Glass and Eno, who would you do it?
Ooh. You've thrown that at me and expected me to have an answer straight away.
Yeah. Because I don't know.
So,
like, I'm a huge Travis fan, but I don't think that would lead itself well to my work. I might maybe do the Smiths. If I wanted to get into one of those relationships, I think it would be the Smiths. I think I could do a lot with a Johnny Marr guitar. And that would be really cool.
Yeah. I don't know. My route into music as an 8-year-old was my dad's Pink Floyd albums. So I think I could go somewhere there.
Oh, that explains a lot.
Yeah, I could work with them.
Yeah. Or maybe, what was my route in? My mum listened to a lot of Rod Stewart. Particularly, Every Picture Tells a Story, which is a very good album. We shouldn't be too mean on Rod Stewart. Or Bowie. I listened to a lot of Bowie and a lot of Madness and a lot of Blondie, Pretenders, that kind of punk.
Oh, yeah, sort of new wave stuff.
Yeah, new wave punk. Yeah.
Yeah.
No Pink Floyd in our house.
No, my dad's record collection was very 70s oriented. So, yeah, Pink Floyd, a lot of Led Zeppelin in there as well. But Pink Floyd was the sort of music that grabbed me when I was young, because it was just different to everything else on the shelf.
Yeah. Should we talk about the orchestration?
Yeah.
I feel like
I
it
mean, where do you want
sounds
to go with this?
like, I just want to talk about the general feeling of the orchestration.
Yeah.
Which is, I feel like every part of the spectrum is covered. Like if it was a canvas of sound, every single space on that canvas would have something on it.
Yeah.
It's a kind of all or nothing orchestration in
Yeah.
this.
My feeling with this was that the strings were used very much as the sort of,
It's like a.
I don't know,
Did you
the if
ever
this was
have
like a if
the
this was like a
orchestra?
curry, the strings are the rice which everything else is sort of sitting on.
Oh, you see, I always talked about the orchestra as a cake. Oh,
Cake,
typical.
okay.
Yeah. So the strings are the sponge.
Yeah.
And
They're doing the unglamorous but necessary role.
yeah, you need the strings, otherwise you've got no orchestra. So you need your sponge cake. Otherwise, there's nothing else. And then your brass is the icing.
Okay.
And then the woodwind are the sprinkles on top. That's how it was explained to me.
Okay. See, I'm not sure I agree that's necessarily what you need for every
Well,
piece.
no, like I think maybe it would be a better explanation to call the woodwind so flutes, clarinets, oboes, bassoons, to make that the icing and make the brass the currants or like a filling or something in the cake. Like you don't need it, but it's nice when it's there.
Okay.
Like
I see what you're getting at there. Well, what I'm saying is I don't think the strings must always be the sponge.
what?
But what I was trying to say was, with reference to the orchestration in this one, I feel like the strings are playing a rather plain role, hence why I was going with rice, and all the flavour is in the other parts. And there are string melodies, but a lot of the time the strings are doing these sort of repetitive, glassy type figurations in the background, while other parts,
What do you mean by that?
they feel
Like,
like they're the accompaniment a lot of the time to me.
but by the
Oh
glassy,
yeah, like
lassy,
repeating
configurations.
patterns. Yeah, repeating patterns like we talked about
Yeah.
but earlier on in the minimalism. You sort of have this pattern, you repeat it, and you change it slightly, slowly over time. And I
So
felt like.
there's an example of that, which is arpeggiation, which is further along in the first movement where it goes da 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 over and
Yeah.
over again. That kind of bit. Is that the bit you're
Yeah.
meaning?
But even when there are melodies going on, you've still got that sort of pattern going on in the strings a lot of the time, and not just in the first movement, in a lot of the movements.
I think there's also some really good ominous brass.
Love a bit of ominous brass.
I like a bit of ominous brass. I like to think that it's a bit foghorny. Some of the brass.
Watch out, there's a ship coming out of the fog.
I honestly think of this piece as the modern equivalent of the. This whole symphony is the modern equivalent of the Planet Suites. So Holst's Planets. It's
In
got
what
that.
way?
It, oh, this is so untechnical. It feels spacey.
That might be the David Bowie influence.
Yeah, but it's got that kind of like, oh, I'm flying through space on a spaceship and look, there's strings around me and all that. This is really...
No, I get what you're saying.
Yeah, it's just got that kind of feel. It's something to do with the speed that it moves at, the rhythm of the brass, because they're never on the beat, so... You've got the kind of 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, ba, 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 ba kind of thing.
You can imagine Vangelis doing a synth arrangement of it for a sci-fi film.
Yeah, but then that would be a bit rubbish.
Yeah, but you can still imagine it happening.
Sorry. I suppose what I mean is it wouldn't be out of place in Wall-E. In a Disney film that's set in space and they're off on this spacey adventure.
Okay. Yeah, I see your point.
That's not what came into my head when I listened to it. I can't explain it, but it just feels really related to the Holst. Maybe if I play a bit of the Holst, I'll be able to explain it better. This is Jupiter... this is Holst the Planets, Opus 32, Jupiter, the Bringer of Jollity. It's got that kind of feeling of like you're speeding towards something.
Yeah. And then the strings doing their thing, twinkly.
Mmm. Such a fit bit of orchestration.
It's an amazing tune.
Right. So, that was Jupiter.
Yeah, having that in my head, I can 100% see how you got there.
Yeah.
Off
well,
Heroes.
I think I might do...
Especially the first
V2,
and last movement, V2 Schneider, I think.
V2 Schneider.
Yeah.
See, they just feel like...
Yeah, especially as this develops a bit, this movement.
Hmm. I really just want to sit and listen to the rest of it, but that's not conducive to what we're doing, is it? But I feel like I've made my point.
Here we go. There's the Jupiter bit just coming in now. A
little bit of sinister brass as well.
It's just missing the timpani, I think.
Yeah. But I've always linked the two in my head.
Yeah,
By the way, is this the most tuneful piece we've done so far? Specials aside.
Possibly. Yeah. I mean, I've only been involved in a few of them, so...
And I chose it, so that's a surprise.
What, you think I choose the more tuneful pieces?
No, just that I think I choose more abstract pieces normally.
Okay. I think I've only made one choice so far, technically.
Yeah. Yeah, you've got one coming next week. It's in the diary.
Yeah. What will it be?
Building the suspense.
Tune in a fortnight to find out.
Right. That's basically what I had to say about the orchestration, is I felt like I was flying through space and that this is a companion piece for Holst.
Yeah. I'd be interested to hear them programmed together.
I wrote a blog a while back about gateway pieces to contemporary classical music. And this was on the back of the BBC had done their own list. And they'd also commissioned some new pieces. And I felt like the pieces that they'd chosen weren't actually the best gateway ones. So, you know, it was a lot of... John Adams and pieces like that. And I put the Hero Symphony on my list. And I think I'd put it in there really because it feels like a companion to the Holst. And people are so fond of the Holst. You know, people with no classical background or way in. It's a really accessible suite of pieces. So I think that's why I added that into my blog.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's... I can see your point, although... How far Philip Glass is ever a gateway into the whole of the sort of contemporary classical scene is maybe not the debate to be having in this podcast.
No, not the whole of the contemporary scene. Just for minimalism, it's good. It's accessible.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a nice start for minimalism.
And it's an unthreatening start. You're not going to start someone off with Stockhausen.
No, my go-to is A Rainbow in Curved Air, I think.
By Terry Riley.
Yeah.
Who was on a lot of drugs.
And you can hear them in the music.
Oh, double rainbow.
Yeah.
So my brownies the other week started talking about the double rainbow video. And they had no idea of the context of Double Rainbow.
Yes, well, they're so only, what, 5 years old?
No, 7 to 10.
Oh, dear.
So they were talking about, like, how funny this video was, and I was just like, I think we're just going to stop talking about this.
Yeah. While we were talking about people not getting the context of things, I actually played some Bowie to some of my sixth form students the other day.
Oh, go on. Can we talk about this?
Yeah, I played them. What did I play them? Can you hear me, mate? What's the song? What's the name of the song? I know the song.
Space Oddity.
Space Oddity. I played them Space Oddity. And we were talking about why this song is very 1969 and, you know, what's going on in it. And not one of them spotted that the whole sort of space thing was... a big sort of picture of how it feels to be on drugs. they were all very naive, and when I then sort of dropped that on them, they were rather taken aback at the new context they had to look at this song in.
I got offered drugs once, at a train station, and I was with some friends, and it was in sixth form, and this guy came up to us and went, "Do you sniff?" And we went, "Sorry." He went, "Do you sniff?" It's like, what? Sorry. Do you sniff cocaine? Oh, not today, thank you. It was so like Famous Five of us.
That's the worst drug dealer ever.
Do you sniff? What a day. And on that note, I think we're going to move on to our next session, onto the food section. First of all, to bring it back to the Bond and Buns themes that we'd made.
Oh, yeah.
So I put it out there and there was not much response. So how I've measured this is I put a poll up on Twitter, only I voted. So I don't think I can... count that because I voted for me.
I'm going to vote for me right now, even things out.
Oh, just to put this in context for people who didn't listen last week, Jono and I wrote our own themes for James Bond. In our own styles. So we put them out there, for votes. So I put them on SoundCloud. We now have SoundCloud for the podcast. That's Symphonies and Snacks. You can find us there. And... mine got a favourite on SoundCloud from somebody.
Is it somebody you know?
Nope. No idea who this person is.
That counts.
So that counts. We got an equal number of plays on SoundCloud. It was 13 each. And then on Twitter, you got a retweet from someone we don't know.
Brilliant.
So I'm taking that as a tie.
Yeah, I think that feels like a tie.
That's the fairest way to do this, isn't it?
We tied on plays, you won on likes on SoundCloud, I got a retweet on Twitter. I think that's a 2-2 draw.
I mean, basically, we both did really badly. Nobody cared.
Yeah.
I
put a lot of work into that.
I put 20 minutes into
that. I put literally 45 minutes into making that work. And 15 of those minutes were trying to find some system I'd last used 4 years ago.
Yeah. But, I mean, we'll keep trying doing the creative challenges. I think it kind of worked.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it.
I had fun doing it.
So let's talk food. I have lots of Bowie puns.
Well, you are the pun meister, so fire away.
So I've been talking to friend of the show, James Etheridge, who is my punning friend.
Everyone has one.
Yep. Oh, I have many.
You may not know it yet, but you do.
So my first gambit is I would be eating miniature heroes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the chocolate and the symphony that we're listening to.
Yeah. No, I get you. Yeah, I get you. That's not really a pun because they're both called hero. Okay. Right. Fine. Yeah, you can have
it. So we're going to move from there. So we have a big list. It's hit and miss. Okay. Is there life on marzipan?
Sorry, you missed the opportunity there to go with, is there life on Mars bars?
That would be much easier than marzipan.
Yes.
That's James's, it's marzipan. I had under pressure cooker.
Yep.
Which I should say James was writing as I hit send on that text. Then we're going Ziggy based. James had Ziggy pudding.
Oh, that's good. Also, you know, we're not that far off Christmas.
Ziggy star mix.
Yep.
No.
Yeah, no, I get where you're going there. I prefer Ziggy pudding. I think it works better.
Right. So then James came back with cream genie.
I'm struggling to. I mean, genie, yeah, but what's the food? Are you just changing cream? Okay, just cream. Okay, yeah. No,
and
don't
then
like
I followed
one.
Up with Revels.
Yeah, no, that's good, that's good.
Which I was really proud of. Taste Oddity.
Yeah, no, that's I like
James.
That, yeah.
Yeah, that's good work. And then he followed with Flame. I'm not sure where the food is in that one.
No, neither do I. I have one, though, this week.
Go on.
I don't really like this food, but you could have goulashes to ashes.
Goulashes
yes. to ashes.
Yeah, we couldn't think of an ashes to ashes one. That's great.
Score one for me, the least punnable person in the world.
So then James followed with golden bears, but I think it would be better if it was golden beers.
Yeah, that makes more sense. And right. It rhymes.
And then I followed up with dancing with some beef. Which I just really enjoyed. And then I had star flan.
Okay. That's...
Which I wrote some words for.
Oh, I need to hear these.
I've been told that they're awful, but I'm going to read them anyway. There's a star flan waiting with some pies. I'd like to go and eat them, but I think they'd blow my mind.
Is that it? That's quite
it,
good.
That's it.
Maybe at half time of a football game or something, you could have some oranges. No?
That doesn't work.
It rhymes with changes, almost.
It's not oranges.
Oranges. Well, I don't know. I'm trying hard. I'm not as good at puns as you.
Yeah.
Clearly.
Well, I mean, there were two of us working on that. Goulashes to ashes, though, I'll give you that one.
Yeah, I'm quite pleased with that.
That's like 3 weeks worth of puns.
Yeah, but I'd tell you, you'll be going some to come up with puns next week.
Yeah. Oh, that's a challenge. Who are we doing next week?
Sariaho.
Sariaho.
Yeah.
Well, you were drinking Sariaho. Oh, no, that's not a thing. Yazoo, that's... I'll get there.
I think Yahoo is a thing. but I don't think it's a drink.
Right. Other things to cover in our middle section where we go off on a tangent. This is our designated tangent section. Did you realise that?
We haven't spoken about Les Mis this week.
No, but I've got an even better one coming soon.
Okay, cut that bit out then.
No, I'm keeping that in. Right, have you heard about the academic who's dressing as Bowie?
No.
He's living as Bowie.
He's living as... Which era Bowie?
So, this is Professor Will Brooker, and he's from Kingston. Is he from Kingston University?
I don't know.
Yeah, he's... teaches film and cultural studies at Kingston University, and he's spending a few months at a time at each of the specific identifiable moments from Bowie's life. Because David Bowie, you can really, you know, you can
He has some clear eras in his life, doesn't he?
Well, I mean, he has, you know, like the Ziggy era and, you know, all of that.
Yeah. I've just Googled Professor Will Brooker, and I can confirm there are a lot of photos of him dressed as David Bowie.
Maybe we'll tweet some later.
Yeah.
So apparently, the idea is to inhabit Bowie's headspace at points in his life and career to understand his work from an original angle while retaining a critical and objective perspective at the same time. A kind of split persona, perhaps. I'm looking at this not to, you know, ridicule someone else's studies, but isn't this just cosplay?
Very, yes. Basically, yes.
It's Bowie cosplay.
It's more than just dressing up. It's trying to get into the mental state of that person. Therefore, it's cosplay.
Yeah. And also, he's not like... He's saying, like...
can I say,
it's
however...
It's immersion.
Yeah. This guy's getting paid for this, so good work if you can get it.
Yeah, fair enough. He has also said, in relation to Heroes, I think my immersion has confirmed... This is a tweet. My immersion has confirmed the reason for Bowie's supposedly boring Heroes album hair. He wanted to become more anonymous. So I think he's having a bit of a hard plan. So he plans to watch the same films Bowie would have done, and he has submitted himself to sleep deprivation and some weekends only eaten red peppers and drunk only milk. The project also involves listening only to songs that Bowie would have heard. I think he's missing a very big thing here about
why... Has he taken any drugs?
Well, yeah, that's... Bowie wasn't just eating red peppers and drinking milk because he's a wild and crazy guy. He was high.
A lot of the time, yeah.
So much of the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's a wonder Bowie is still alive, to be honest. The amount of drugs he was on at certain points in his life.
I mean, he's alive and he doesn't look like Keith Richards. Like, he's doing well.
Yeah.
Right. Well, he addresses this. He's like, the levels of cocaine Bowie was consuming. It's not just illegal for a professor like myself, but it's much too expensive, as well as unhealthy.
So those are the most... That's, yeah. So first up, illegal. Second, expense. And third is, oh, it's probably not very good for me.
Yeah.
So he
has a six-pack of energy drinks at the weekend to try and simulate the experience of illegal substances.
That's fantastic. So basically, he's saying, you know what, it's illegal, but if I could afford it, I would be.
Pretty much, yeah.
Oh, dear. This
guy's
brilliant. I can see why you like him. His PhD's on Batman.
Is it?
Yeah.
Where's that?
What
aspect of Batman? What Batman?
I don't know. I'm just reading his biography.
I must know the facts now.
All it says is, while first completing his PhD and then expanding it into Batman Unmasked, Will Brooker received a degree of media coverage unusual for an academic. So all it says is his PhD turned into something called Batman Unmasked.
I wrote my dissertation on Batman, but it was distinctly average. It was very average.
Hang on. His PhD thesis was titled One Life, Many Faces, The Uses and Meanings of the Batman, 1939 to 1999.
That's wide. That's wide-ranging.
Yeah, I think it's... see if I can find more information on it, but I think it seems to be sort of... His PhD was in cultural studies, so
So I wrote my undergraduate dissertation on the 89 Batman.
Yeah.
And on the music in that and the characterisation. And then recently, I was watching the film again, because I watch it two or three times a year, the 89 one, the Tim Burton one. And I suddenly had this moment of, that was what I should have written. Just that little nugget there would have made a very good dissertation.
Yeah.
If I'd just taken one small thing.
By the looks of things, his work is on the character of Batman rather than Batman films or the Batman books or anything. It's just how the character is used and how it gets reused throughout history as a cultural icon, from what I could work out.
Well, it's interesting because he was kind of created as an anti-Superman, because Superman was there as Mr. All-America, and he came about when people were very uneasy about the rise of the Nazis and all this kind of thing. You had this great American hero, and then you needed something to counter that, and they created Batman.
Who's not a superhero.
No. Who is... Well, is this a funny thing about Tim Burton and his casting? Because his casting of Michael Keaton in the 89 one was very controversial. This is a good tangent.
It's all about heroes.
So the casting of Michael Keaton, which people really hated initially, he was like, well, I have to cast somebody who looks like he really... In order to defend himself, he would dress up as a bat. Like some Hollywood, you know, guy with a really strong jawline and stuff. Why would he dress up as a bat at night? What kind of freak does that?
Yeah, fair enough.
Michael
Can't
Keaton.
Fault his logic.
Yeah. I'm worried about Affleck. Very worried about Affleck.
Okay.
Mm. Not in general, as Batman.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I think, you know, he's got an Oscar, he's doing fine.
The second mention of Affleck on tonight's podcast.
Is it?
Did we not talk about him at the first, or was that someone else?
I don't think we've talked about Affleck.
Okay.
I don't bring him up much.
No.
No, he's not my normal rotation of people that I talk about.
Ooh, here we go. So this is me quoting Wikipedia. Entertainment Weekly describes Batman Unmasked as cutting through the mumbo-jumbo to deliver incisive analysis and very sharp reporting. Brooker engages with the major dialogue surrounding the topic, including the question of Batman's role as a patriotic figure, questions of his sexuality, and the role of Batman as a viable queer text.
My other favourite Batman book... No, I have a couple of favourite Batman books. I've got a Batman Encyclopedia that cross-references everything in the comics. Like, everything.
So you can work out which universe, which comic fits in, so that there's no continuity errors.
Yeah. And it goes through all of it. And the second one I've got is Batman and Philosophy. So it takes all those really large philosophical questions and puts them in the context of Batman. So why doesn't Batman kill the Joker? Because if he killed the Joker, he'd guarantee that the world would be safe, because the Joker always kills again. Well, you can't guarantee that the Joker will kill again, and if Batman kills the Joker, then he's as bad as the Joker. And all of those philosophical things within the context of Batman.
Yeah.
That's what I was
Batman
reading
when we
were
doesn't kill the Joker because comic book authors want to bring characters back as often as they can, but... Yeah.
No. It was a decision that the writers made, that Batman, in the comic books, in the films it's different, but in the comic books he never kills.
Never kills. Okay. You know more about Batman than me. I will bow to your Batman knowledge.
This was what I was doing during our undergraduate.
Yeah, when you were supposed to be studying music.
Yep, studying Batman.
And you still got a music degree out of it, so yeah, well done.
Yep. And a distinctly average dissertation.
Made up for it with your compositions.
Yes. I'm much better at that than musicology. Which I think we're learning here by the number of tangents.
This is the official tangent section.
Yes, this is Tangent Corner.
We should have like a theme tune.
Is it a tangent corner or a tangent cul-de-sac?
Probably a cul-de-sac, because eventually we sort of have to back out of it and go back where we were.
Yeah. And to take some information that I learnt from Gilmore Girls, the plural of cul-de-sac is cul-de-sac.
if you're being fully correctly with the French, I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
We've got all your favourite things in tonight, haven't we?
Yeah.
Bowie, Batman, Gilmore Girls. I mean, what else is left?
I haven't done They Miss.
No.
One Day More. And a whole load of puns.
Yeah, but yeah, that's sort of par for the course. You would expect nothing less.
Other things in David Bowie news is he has just this week refused to let Danny Boyle do a musical of his work.
And we're all very happy for it, are we?
I don't know. There's a rise in jukebox musicals, isn't there?
Yeah. But I don't know how many of them are worthy.
Good. Well, one of our colleagues at uni used to write about jukebox musicals. Judith.
Yeah.
Judith Keane. He's a friend of ours. I don't know. It's a real... Because you've got the fan base in place. So it's an easy sell having a jukebox musical.
It's easy to sell for one run of shows, but how many of them go on?
Well, Mamma Mia.
Mamma Mia and We Will Rock You are the two that come to my mind as sort of going beyond an initial run and doing some tours and getting repeat showings and stuff like that.
And Jersey Boys. Jersey Boys is really good. Still going.
Everybody where I work at the moment is going to see this new Carole King musical, Beautiful.
Carole King, who wrote the theme tune to the Gilmore Girls.
I did not know that, but then again, I don't watch the Gilmore Girls.
Well, your loss. I got a jumper for my birthday and it says on it, I'd rather be watching Gilmore Girls. And so, it's a great jumper because I can just passive-aggressively stand next to people. So I can go out to the pub and wear this jumper and let everybody know that I would rather be at home watching the Gilmore Girls.
I imagine you're wearing it right now.
Yep.
Jukebox musicals.
What would you want to see in a David Bowie jukebox musical? Because I went to the Spice Girls one with a friend, Kim. Oh, who's been on the show, Kim Moore. And what we really loved was the really bad starts to the song. So they start going, well, you know, I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want.
Yeah, and then it breaks down into a song, yeah. But that's the problem with a jukebox musical is you have to have more than just some good songs that people like to sing along with. You have to somehow stitch them together into a plot as well.
Well, that's where the Jersey Boys is good because it's biographical.
It works quite well in Mamma Mia as well. It's a bit contrived, but it works all right. I think in We Will Rock You, it's very contrived, but it's sort of big enough and showy enough that people don't notice sometimes. The thing about David Bowie and doing a jukebox musical with him is that, I mean, especially some of his earlier stuff, there are concept albums which have plots already as part of them. I don't know if it would be right to sort of rip them apart to make a new plot.
Yeah.
And, I mean, if you're going to do a
Unless you
Bowie
just
musical,
like
you're going
Spiders
to go with...
Mars.
Yeah, you're going to go with something like The Spaceman, you know, or Ziggy Stardust or something like that, which he sort of already explored in his own way, those characters.
I mean, the thing is as well, he's so... Well, you know, he's David Bowie. He's minted. He's married to a supermodel. He's got a young family. He doesn't need this.
And, yeah, the other thing I would also say...
And also, if he was going to give it to any director, wouldn't he give it to his son?
Yeah.
Duncan Jones.
Yeah.
Who would more understand what would work.
But the other thing about Bowie as well is these other musicals we've mentioned tonight, the groups who the musical were made out of have a sort of unifying style throughout the oeuvre, whereas Bowie has done so many different things. Trying to stitch that many different styles of music together into a musical would be really quite hard work, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So, should we talk a bit more about kind of the enduring appeal of heroes? So,
yeah,
Glass used it, and, you know, they've got this ongoing relationship between themselves, and they have collaborated since as well, which was really interesting. I found a really interesting video of them chatting together, which I think we'll tweet, which was just kind of like, you know, somebody had asked Bowie if he influenced Glass's work, and he's like, no, I just kind of leave him to it. You know, just this real, they were really comfortable with each other.
Yeah.
Like, they really just trust each other to do what they do. Why do you think Bowie stays, has such an enduring appeal?
I think partly it's what we've talked about, the fact that he evolves his music with the times, but his music is never fully of the time. It's always sort of different, but different in a contemporary way, if that makes sense. So it sort of stands out from the crowd of what's around it, but it doesn't reject its place in time. It says, hey, this is the time I'm in. This is the crowd. Here's me standing off to one side, but I'm not turning my back on that crowd. I'm just doing something a bit different from them, but it's still modern in its way. And throughout his career, I think that's sort of where Bowie has pitched his music, as a bit alternative, but still contemporary, still up with the times, still accessible. And it's given him great longevity, and I think because of that, you know, great influence and people.
I think as well, there's something in, I always talk about music and composers in three camps. I don't know if you do this. There's the people who innovate, the people who perfect, and the people who maintain.
Okay, no, this is a new categorization to me. I don't think in that way.
So, Mozart perfected. So he did things and he took forms and he really just made it kind of the best it can be. So he's a great example of classical, and classical done really well and done the best it could be.
Yeah.
People will disagree with me on this classification.
Yes.
Beethoven was innovation. He was trying new things. He was in the end of the classical era, the beginning of the romantic, you know, he was that kind of bridge and he was forging the way and he was trying new stuff and really, you know, trying out larger orchestras, newer ways of expressing that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then you've got somebody like, well, it's even difficult to think of them, but somebody like, I don't know, Salieri maintained the status quo to produce the kind of music that was being produced at that time.
Maybe Gluck would be a good example.
Yeah, or Gluck. So you really remember the innovators. You really remember the perfectors, the people who really made the style what it was.
Mm.
But you don't really remember the people who maintain.
Yeah. No, I think that's an interesting way of looking at things. I can see your point of view. It's a little bit controversial because I think a lot of the times the ones who perfect are also the ones who innovate.
But they're innovating within what's fashionable at the time.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
So I think they more stick with the prevailing styles.
Hmm.
So I think Bowie, I put Bowie in the innovation category.
Yeah.
Because he's constantly looking for new things, and there's stuff that he released that at the time people were kind of like, oh, no. You know,
in fact,
there's
these Berlin albums were not particularly commercially successful. There's too many instrumentals on them for people and things like that.
And anything that people are just a bit unsure of as it's released. You know, like the Sgt. Pepper's album and that kind of stuff. I would put in the innovation category, and it does count elsewhere as well. So, you know, like Stravinsky was an innovator because people really hated what he was doing at the time. You know, that kind of, it's pushing things and it makes people a bit uncomfortable. I would say Glass perfects.
Yeah. Well, if you think about the sort of American minimalist school, and that's a controversial classification in and of itself, and I think most people.
So, who would you include in the American minimalist school?
I would include Reilly, Reich, Glass, Lamont Young to a certain extent.
It's Lamont Young in the
John room. Adams a little bit.
I'm really sorry.
Sorry, what were we about to say about Lamont Young?
I said, is Lamont Young in the room?
Lamont Young? He's always in the room.
Which is a piece, so if you're going to do any of his work, you stand up beforehand and say, is Lamont Young in the room? And that's like the original, like the opening piece of a Lamont Young concert. Anyway.
Yeah. So, and I mean, I don't think any of those five who I've mentioned would consider themselves to be a school per se, but you can't deny that from the sort of 60s, you got these musicians coming out of mainly the East Coast of the United States. I know Riley was on the West Coast.
Riley's in a desert somewhere, isn't he?
Yeah, Arizona or something, isn't it, normally?
He just sits out in the desert.
Sits out in a desert playing the organ. but yeah, with these sort of repetitive ideas that came to be classed as minimalism, although they all went about it in a different way.
Mm.
I forget where I was getting off. Yeah, yes, so I think Glass certainly didn't originate that as a style. I can see an argument for him being one who perfected it, and perhaps John Adams would be one who maintained it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of how I see it. I was trying to think of maintaining in terms of popular music, but the problem is they all kind of fall by the wayside. They're all those songs that you just think, oh, that was a thing. You know,
well, think about how many chart songs you can remember from last year.
Oh my God, I don't listen to chart songs.
Exactly, but what sort of big popular songs are still in your consciousness from last year?
I'm not sure I can remember any. Oh, that's really bad. That's down on me. But Taylor Swift, Blank Space.
Blank Space, okay. That sits in your head?
Yeah.
I would say that one and probably Uptown Funk, which was right at the start of the year.
Yeah.
I can remember being in the charts. And actually, if I remember one Taylor Swift, I remember she had a couple of others in the charts of that album as well.
Happy as well.
That was a couple of years back, wasn't it?
Is it?
But basically, I think all of those songs had a more than 1 week at or near number one. But there were, in between them, lots of songs which just sort of washed over you and came and went, and you didn't really... I mean, I don't listen to the chart music a lot myself, but in my role as a music teacher, I have to be aware of what music is going around. So there's sort of stuff that washes over you and the stuff that stands out.
Yeah. And what do you think, Taylor Swift, perfecter or innovator?
I think Taylor Swift is a perfecter.
I think she's a perfecter. I think those are well-produced albums.
They're very, very slick albums. And what I'll say is that I think her biggest strength is her country background, because it gives her... All her songs have a narrative.
Mm.
Yeah? And I think that's because she comes from the background of country and western, where you write ballads and you write narratives and stuff into your songs. And so she writes these sort of, which are, they're not really country songs these days. She writes these sort of really, really well-produced pop songs, but she writes them with that sort of narrative that you get in a country song.
To bring this back to Bowie and back to experimental techniques, in terms of lyrics, I think Bowie used to use Dadaist poetry techniques.
That would not surprise me.
And it might be Moon Age Daydream. I'm going to have to look this up now just to make sure that I'm not talking utter bull. But I remember a clip of him writing the lyrics where he just literally had loads and loads of cut up words and he was just picking them out of the hat and putting them together.
Okay.
Yeah.
But, I mean, his sentences and stuff make sense in a lot of the songs, but yeah.
But I could see him... I would really like to find the fact about to, information to back this up. But it's basically, so he was just picking, yeah, it's called the cut-up technique.
Yeah, well, you know, so collaging and stuff is very part of the Dadaist movement, so.
So you take a load of text and then you cut it all up and then you pick it out at random and arrange it together. I actually did it at Guides once.
Really?
Yeah,
I think I can imagine that Guides and Brownies would go for that as, you know, cutting and pasting and having a lot of fun with glue.
We build fire. We go on adventures.
I'm not saying you don't. I'm just saying, given their age range, scissors and glue is a way of entertaining them.
So, Bowie used to use this for lyrics sometimes. I think it may have been at peak cocaine, potentially.
I like peak cocaine as a sort of official term.
Yeah. From the early 70s, he used this.
Yeah.
But it was Moon Age Daydream that I really remember seeing footage of him doing it, because it starts with, "I'm an alligator."
Okay. Yeah.
"I'm a mama papa calling for you. I'm a space invader." So I think, you know, in terms of lyrics, that makes sense.
Yeah, I can see that. If you find that video, maybe tweet it.
Yes. It's fascinating. I just find anything like that, and anything from the time, and also anything interviewing Bowie at peak cocaine, where you should look at him and go, "Oh my God, that man's not going to live another year." And he's 68.
And got another album coming out in a few months' time.
I mean, fair play to him. I hope he's in Zoolander 2.
Was he in Zoolander 1?
He was. He judged the walk-off.
Ah, I remember that. It's been a long time since I watched Zoolander.
Fashion.
Yeah.
Which brings me on to more of the enduring appeal. Did you like my nice segue there?
That was a fantastic segue. Fashion.
Fashion. Turn to the left.
Style. The look.
So, in popular culture, David Bowie has absolutely huge influence, including on Flight of the Conchords. I was going to play part of their Bowie song, but I think we might start with Fashion.
That's not even in the Bowie episode.
No, it's called... So there's two songs. We're going to start with Fashion is a Danger.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Which goes... Just because it's great. Just, you know, you see around the walk up.
Yeah. Look.
But even better than this, in Flight of the Conchords, Ivra. Ivra? Can we say Ivra for them?
I used that word once already tonight, so I hope they do.
Yes. Is their Bowie song. And the funny thing about their Bowie song is it brings out all the different eras of Bowie that we were talking about.
Yeah.
So put it in context, Brett's having some problems with his self-esteem. So David Bowie comes with him. It comes to him at night to talk about his self-esteem.
When David Bowie comes to him at night in a dream form.
Yes.
So we're in full-on Ziggy Stardust mode here. Or Space Oddity, really, yeah.
It's Space Oddity.
It's Space Oddity, yeah.
Yeah. Isn't it cold out in space, Bowie? Do you want to borrow my jumper, Bowie? Does the space
make your nipples? The funny thing is, most of my students don't know this, but they do that same accent when talking about Bowie. As telescopic
antennae to transmit. Well, because the other person who does that.
By way.
Oh, here we go. Different era of Bowie.
Yeah.
This is your kind of. What era is this? Changes.
Yeah.
Hell yeah, man.
your signal free, cause my radar screen. How far out
of
Hunky Dory, isn't it?
Yeah. You've got to have a pretty strong brand for somebody to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And other places in popular culture, just to talk more about the enduring and kind of wide appeal of Bowie. You know, for someone who's taking influences from contemporary classical music and bringing them all in, he's still so approachable.
Hmm.
You know, it's not this niche thing. It's very warm and inviting, and what contemporary music could be if we just sorted out how people talk about it. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, I can see where you're going. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So the other thing is, to take us off on another tangent, is he features very strongly in Moulin Rouge by Baz Luhrmann.
Yep.
So he sings Nature Boy in the opening. He does a cover of Nature Boy. And the whole, there's one original song in the whole film, and then the rest is intentionally borrowed from other places.
Yeah.
So that's the idea. So they're great love songs from throughout the eras.
Yeah.
So then we have the Elephant Love Medley, which is one of my favourite bits. This is, I've definitely taken us off on a real tangent. I'm not actually sure how much content we've talked today.
We're mostly talking Bowie and not so much about Glass, but yeah.
Because he's just more interesting.
It's true.
Yeah, Glass, you're a very nice man, but, you know, you didn't spend most of the 70s on cocaine, I don't think.
And you get your students to write your music for you now.
Oh. I didn't say that. If you're coming for anyone, if you're going to beat up anyone, beat up Jono.
Can we cut that out at the release?
Right. So, from the Elephant Love Medley. So this is Ewan McGregor's character is trying to convince Nicole Kidman's character, who's a courtesan, prostitute, to go out with him. So he's a penniless writer, and he's got this whole thing. So he's one of the bohemian movement, so he really feels that love is the answer. Right. We're going to go for about 2 minutes.
Just for one day. You will be me.
No, I won't.
And I'll drink all the time.
Oh, Nicole. We should be
lovers. She's doing the Meerkat ads now.
Is she?
Yeah.
Some in the West End. By the way, what a voice.
Yeah. Ewan McGregor looks so young in this film.
He was. It's 2002? Yeah, I know.
2001, I think.
2001. I was 12. So I suppose, bringing this all back round, the interesting thing about that arrangement of Heroes is it very heavily borrows from the orchestration from the Glass.
Yeah. Yeah, it's big and lush, and the strings are doing their thing in the bottom, and the wind and stuff are swelling over the top.
And there's a lot of the repeated patterns that Glass uses, and that Bowie was influenced to use via Glass. That's all in there, in this very shiny package, I think is the best way to describe Moulin Rouge.
The best way to describe any Baz Luhrmann film is lush, and I think it's an apt word here.
Mm. So that's kind of all I have to say on this today. I've covered off all my notes. I've talked absolute nonsense. I took us on a Batman tangent.
I think I took us on the Batman tangent, but you just ran with it.
You can't bring it up because I just will. So you can follow the show at Symphony Snack on Twitter. We're also on SoundCloud now. Or you can email us symphoniesandsnacks@gmail.com. We have an email address now. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Yep. So get in touch if you want to correct us on anything. I imagine that's what the majority of it would be. Or if Glass, you want to set up that fight with Jono for those wild accusations he
pointed out
just
then. Remove.
Nope, they're staying in.
Oh, fine. I stand by them then.
Then please email us. We would love to hear from you. Or if you'd like to leave a review on iTunes, please do, good or bad. We would love to hear your thoughts on the show. Jono, where can people follow you?
You can get me at Jono Firth.
Yep. And I'm at LA Harrison Music on Twitter, on Instagram, just generally everywhere.
Yeah, I'm only on Twitter. I'm not so socially media savvy type.
Are you on SoundCloud?
No, I'm not on SoundCloud because of PRS and stuff. I don't know.
Oh, okay. Other things to point out. I thought I had some. We'll be back hopefully in 2 weeks' time. We're going to get back to the 2 week schedule. Again, apologies for slowing us down.
It was an extra week off.
Yeah.
Half term was in there. We can maybe pretend that we were just away for half term or something.
Yes, that sounds good.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else you want to say at this point? Anything else you want to plug?
No, just tune in next week, where we'll be talking about a female composer.
Yes, a lady composer.
Yeah.
And I can have my favourite rant about how they're not women composers, they're just composers. You good for me to have that rant? It's like I'm trailing it.
I feel like you need to have that rant next week. But I think so far every composer we've talked about on this show has been male. So I think it's time for that rant.
Yes, it's been a bit of a sausage fest.
To put it politely.
I'm very sorry. That's all we have time for this week. And we're going to play out with... Which movement shall we play out?
I like V2 Schneider.
But we've done some V2 Schneider.
We do, but we started with the first movement. How about then Sons of the Silent Age?
Sons of the Silent Age to play us out. Thank you for listening.
Goodbye.